Well, different clothing, altered lighting conditions, lest Gabriel ever find it necessary to spend a significant period out of the public eye. He reckoned that time had come, though it had arrived far earlier in his tenure than he ever imagined. The chief of the office had nearly died in a coldly calculated attack on the headquarters of a trusted friend and ally in the War on Terror. Therefore, the chief had no recourse but to respond in kind. Such were the rules of the neighborhood. Gabriel would not delegate the task of vengeance to others, nor would he lash out against meaningless targets in the deserts of Iraq and Syria. His target was a man who had built a network of death that had laid siege to the great cities of the civilized world, a man who was financing his operations through the sale of narcotics in Western Europe. He was going to find this man and wipe him from the face of the earth. He would be painstaking in his approach, meticulous, for there was nothing more dangerous, he thought, than a patient man. But he could not wage war against the enemy without a body and a brain. The pain gradually receded like the waters of a severe flood, but his thoughts remained a jumble. The operation was somewhere out there, he knew it, but its plot lines and central characters were lost in the fog of the concussion. He determined that vigorous exercise was in order, not physical but mental. So he played Shamron's old memory games and, in his head, reread dense monographs on Titian, Bellini, Tintoretto, and Veronese. The effort fatigued him. It was exercise, after all. But slowly the operation came into sharper relief. Only the denouement eluded him. He saw a wealthy man, broken, exposed, and willing to do his bidding. But how would he maneuver the man to this place? Slowly he reminded himself, beware the fury of a patient man. Pain disturbed his sleep, as did nightmares of tumbling downward through a maelstrom of masonry and glass and blood. Nevertheless, he woke early on the fourth morning to find his headache gone and his thoughts clear. Rising before Chiara and the children, he went into the kitchen and made coffee, which he drank while watching the news on television. Afterward, he crept into the bathroom and confronted his reflection in the mirror. The image in the glass was, by any objective measure, disturbing. The left side of the face was reasonably intact, but the right, the side that had been turned toward the full force of the blast, was another story entirely. The eye was blackened and swollen, and there were numerous small cuts and abrasions left by flying glass and debris. It was not the face of a chief, he thought. It was the face of an avenger. He filled the basin with scalding water, and slowly, painfully, scraped a week's growth from his chin and cheeks. Each stroke of the razor sent a charge of pain into the base of his spine, and a sneeze, wholly unexpected, left him doubled over for several seconds in agony. Showered, he returned to the bedroom to find that Chiara had risen. He pulled on a pair of gabardine trousers and a dress shirt with only minimal pain, but the effort of tying his Oxford shoes nearly drove him to the sanctuary of his bed. Smiling tightly to conceal his discomfort, he went into the kitchen where Chiara was preparing a fresh pot of coffee. "All better?" She handed him a cup of coffee and looked him up and down. "Please tell me you're not thinking about going to King Saul Boulevard." In truth, he was. But the tone of Chiara's voice led him to reconsider. "Actually," he said, "I was hoping to spend some time with the children. And I wanted to look like a person again rather than a patient."
"Good recovery," said Chiara, skeptically.
Just then, there came a chirp of laughter from the nursery. She smiled and whispered,
"And so it begins."
He made a brave show of it. He helped Chiara dress the children, an activity that inflicted on him no small amount of pain, and supervised the chaotic food fight, otherwise known as breakfast. He spent the remainder of the morning playing games, reading stories, watching developmental videos, and changing an endless parade of soiled diapers. Mainly, he wondered how Chiara managed to care for the children alone, day after day, without collapsing with exhaustion or losing her mind. Running one of the world's most formidable intelligence services suddenly seemed a rather trivial pursuit by comparison. Nap time was an oasis. Gabriel slept too, and when he woke, he went onto the terrace to warm his weary body in the Jerusalem sun. This time, however, he brought a stack of reading material, the 500 pages of Jean-Luc Martel's file, a copy of which he had carried out of France. Martel had been the target of on-and-off French interest for more than a decade, and yet, with the exception of two minor scrapes having to do with unpaid taxes, both of which were settled far from public view, his reputation remained beyond reproach. The most recent probe of his business empire had taken place 2 years earlier. It had been launched after a mid-level drug dealer offered to testify against Martel in exchange for a reduced prison sentence. In the end, the case was closed for lack of evidence, though the chief investigating officer, a man with an unassailable character, retired early in protest. Perhaps, not coincidentally, the drug dealer whose accusation started the probe was later found dead in his prison cell, his throat slashed. The investigation produced reams of communications intercepts, some salacious, many prosaic, all insignificant, and several hundred surveillance photos. Rousseau sent along a sampling of the best. There was Jean-Luc Martel at the Cannes Film Festival, Jean-Luc Martel at the Biennale in Venice, Jean-Luc Martel in the front row at Fashion Week in New York, Jean-Luc Martel on his 142-foot motor yacht in the Mediterranean, Jean-Luc Martel on the Rue des Rhônes in Geneva, and Jean-Luc Martel at the gala grand opening of his new restaurant in Paris, which was a smash because, according to one estimate, he dropped a cool 5 million euros to make certain every French celebrity of note was in attendance, along with an American reality television star who was famous for being famous and a pair of American hip-hop artists who had unkind things to say about France's treatment of racial minorities. In none of the photos was Martel alone. The woman was always with him. The unusually tall and long-limbed woman, with wide blue eyes and Nordic blonde hair that fell straight about her square shoulders. She was not French, but English. Curious, for Martel was a public champion of all things Gallic. Her name meant nothing to Gabriel, but her flawless face was vaguely familiar. An ordinary internet search produced more than 4,000 highly professional images. Advertisements for clothing, for jewelry, for an exclusive line of wristwatches, for fragrance, for swimwear, for an Italian sports car of dubious reliability, but all that was in her past. She was now the nominal owner of a well-regarded art gallery in the Place de l'Homo in Saint-Tropez, against which the French authorities had found no fault. A further search of publicly available documents and news items revealed that she was an atrocious driver, had been arrested twice on minor drug charges, and had been involved in a string of questionable romantic entanglements, footballers, actors, a member of parliament, an aging glam rock star who had bedded every other fashion model in Britain. She had never been married, and had no children, parents, or siblings. She was, thought Gabriel, alone in the world. In most of the French surveillance photographs, her gaze was averted, her face downcast, but in one, taken on the Ile Saint-Louis in Paris, she was caught staring directly into the lens of the camera. It was this photograph that Gabriel showed to Uzi Navot late that evening at the small table in Gabriel's kitchen. It was approaching midnight. Navot, who had spent the better part of the last decade on one fad diet or another, was slowly devouring the remnants of Chiara's dinner. He studied the photo carefully between bites. A former recruiter and runner of agents, he had a keen eye for talent. "She's trouble," he said. "Avoid. Think she knows where her famous boyfriend really gets his money?" "A girl like that?" Navot shrugged his heavy shoulders. "She knows. They always know. The gallery is in her name." "You're thinking about getting rough with her?" "It's not my first choice, but one should never limit one's options." "How do you intend to play it?" Gabriel explained, while Navot finished the last of the food. "You'll need a Russian arms dealer," Navot said. "I have one." "Is he married, or does he play the field?" "Married," said Gabriel. "Very married."
"Which flavor?"
"A nice French girl."
"Anyone I know?"
Gabriel gave no answer. Navot stared at the photograph of the beautiful long-limbed woman.
"A girl like that won't come cheap," he said. "You're going to need money."
I know where we can get money, Uzi. Gabriel smiled. Lots of money. Chapter 19. King Saul Boulevard, Tel Aviv. It would be another 72 hours before Jean-Luc Martel, hotelier, restaurateur, clothier, jeweler, and international dealer of illicit narcotics, became the target of full-time office surveillance, along with Olivia Watson, his not-quite wife. The delay had to do with their location and the season of the year. Their location was the enchanted West Indian island of Saint Barthélemy, and the season was late winter, which meant there was not a rental villa or hotel room to be had in the entire resort. Under Gabriel's unrelenting pressure, travel finally managed to lay its hands on a mosquito-infested hut overlooking the salt marshes of Saline. Mordechai and Oded, a pair of all-purpose office field hands, settled there soon after, accompanied by two female escort officers, both of whom spoke American English. The French contributed no personnel, despite the fact that, technically speaking, it was their soil. Paul Rousseau's Alpha Group was in no condition to operate against anyone. It was still mourning its dead and searching for a new clandestine headquarters in Paris. And as far as the rest of official France was concerned, the various ministers, the heads of the intelligence and security services, the police and prosecutors, there was no operation. The target of this non-existent operation, however, had no difficulty in finding accommodation in Saint-Barthélemy. He owned a large villa in the hills above the village of Saint-Jean, from which he could behold his luxury hotel, his boutique specializing in beachwear for women, and his restaurant, which he called Chez Olivia. The first batch of surveillance photos showed her stretched nude beside the pool at Martel's villa. The next depicted her in various stages of undress. Gabriel advised the team to devote its energies to more than photography. He already knew how Olivia Watson looked. What he wanted was hard intelligence. He was rewarded with another photo, this one showing Martel in flagrante delicto with one of the salesgirls from his boutique. Gabriel tucked the picture away for safekeeping, though he was dubious of its potential impact. When a woman entered into a relationship with a Frenchman, especially one as good-looking as Jean-Luc Martel, infidelity was part of the bargain. He only wondered whether Olivia Watson played by the same set of rules. They would remain on Saint-Barthélemy for the next 10 days, unaware of the fact that several thousand miles away, in an anonymous office block in Tel Aviv, their lives were under a sustained, if quiet, assault. Elie Lavon, a skilled financial investigator, burrowed into JLM Enterprises, which, for all its Frenchness, was headquartered just across the border in secretive Geneva. With the help of Unit 8200, Israel's ultra-secret signals intelligence service, Lavon pondered JLM's balance sheets and tax records at his leisure. They revealed that the company was highly profitable indeed. Abnormally so, in the opinion of Lavon, who had a well-trained eye for dirty money. He then analyzed the company unit by unit. The restaurants, the hotels, the nightclubs, the boutiques and jewelry shops, all were in the black. A rather remarkable run of good fortune during a period of sluggish overall economic growth. The same could be said for Galerie Olivia Watson in Saint-Tropez. Indeed, while the rest of the art world was struggling in the post-Great Recession market, Galerie Olivia Watson had sold more than $200 million worth of art during the past 18 months alone. Calder, Pollock, Rothko, Basquiat, three works by Roy Lichtenstein, three more by de Kooning, a couple of Rauschenbergs, and more Warhols than I could count.
Very impressive, said Gabriel.
Especially when you consider the prices she's getting. I compared them to sales at auction houses in New York and London.
And?
Not even close.
Maybe she's a good negotiator, said Gabriel.
I can tell you one thing. She's discreet. Nearly all the sales are totally private.
Were you able to find any shipping waybills?
As a matter of fact, I was.
And?
During the past 6 months, she's shipped 4 paintings to the same address in the Geneva Freeport.
Initially, Lavon conducted his probe from his office on the top floor, but once the hook had been set, he gathered up his files and migrated downward through the building to the cramped subterranean chamber known as Room 456C. The rest of the old Barak team soon joined them. There was tall, balding Yossi Gavish, with his British-accented Hebrew and Danish air, and Ramona Stern, she of the sandstone-colored hair, childbearing hips, and acid tongue. Yakov Rosman, the pockmarked former agent runner who was now the chief of special ops, reclaimed his old spot at the communal table, next to the last chalkboard in all of King Saul Boulevard. Dina Sarid, the officer's walking database of Palestinian and Islamic terrorism, seized her usual place in the far corner. On the blank wall above her desk, she hung an enlargement of the last known photograph of Saladin, the surveillance shot taken in the tri-border area of South America. The message to the others was unmistakable. Jean-Luc Martel and Olivia Watson were mere stepping stones. The ultimate prize was Saladin. Gabriel, with his aching back and ribs, required no such reminder. Occasionally, he poked his head in the door to check on the team's progress, but for the most part, he kept to the top floor and walked an administrative tightrope, a chief one minute, a field man and planner the next. Not since the days of Ari Shamron had a director general held the tiller of an operation so tightly. Even so, the rest of the office's daily business, the myriad of smaller ops, the recruitments in progress, the analysis and assessment of current threats, proceeded as normal thanks to the presence of Uzi Navot just across the hall. This was the maiden voyage of their new partnership, and it went off without a hitch. Navot even accompanied Gabriel to a meeting with the Prime Minister, though unlike Gabriel, he proved powerless to resist the Kung Pao chicken.
"It's the salt," he confessed as they filed out of Kaplan Street. "I'd eat my shoe if it was fried in oil and coated with soy sauce."
As Elie Lavon tunneled into the dubious hospitality conglomerate known as JLM Enterprises, Yossi Gavish and Ramona Stern focused their efforts on Jean-Luc Martel, the man. The story of his humble beginnings had been told often. He did not hide from them. They were, like his mane of almost black hair, part of his allure. As a child, he had lived in a nothing village in the hills of Provence. It was the kind of place, he often recounted, through which the rich and beautiful passed on their way down to the sea. His father had laid tile, his mother had swept and mopped it. She was part Algerian, at least that was the rumor in the village. Jean-Luc's father beat her often. He beat Jean-Luc, too. The father disappeared when Jean-Luc was 17. Some months later, his body was discovered at the bottom of an isolated ravine, a few miles from the village. The skull was in ruins. Blunt force trauma, probably a hammer. Inside French law enforcement, it was widely regarded as Jean-Luc Martel's first murder. In press interviews, Martel spoke often of the fact that he was a poor and disruptive student. University was not an option, so at 18 he made his way to Marseille, where he went to work waiting tables in a restaurant near the Old Port. He studied the business carefully, oh, so the story went, and scraped together enough money to open a restaurant of his own. In time, he opened a second, then a third, and thus an empire was born. The 500 pages of the French file, however, told a rather different version of Jean-Luc Martel's time in Marseille. It was true he worked for a brief time as a waiter, but the restaurant was no ordinary restaurant. It was a money-laundering operation run by Philippe Renard, a high-ranking figure in the French milieu who specialized in the importation and distribution of illegal narcotics. Renard took an instant liking to the handsome young man from the hills, especially after learning that Jean-Luc had killed his own father. Renard taught his young apprentice everything there was to know about the business. He introduced him to suppliers in North Africa and Turkey. He counseled him on how to manage rivalries with other gangs so as to avoid needless bloodshed and publicity, and he instructed him on how to use seemingly legitimate businesses to launder and conceal profits. Martel rewarded Renard's trust by killing him the same way he killed his father, with a hammer, and seizing control of his business. Overnight, Jean-Luc Martel became one of the most important drug figures in France, but he was not content to remain just one among many. Total domination of the trade was his goal. And so he built an army of streetwise killers, mainly Moroccans and Algerians, and unleashed them on his rivals. When the blood finally stopped flowing, Martel was the only one standing. His expansion in the drug trade coincided with his rise in the legitimate world. Each side of the business fueled the other. JLM Enterprises was a criminal undertaking from top to bottom, a giant front-loading washing machine that produced hundreds of millions of clean euros each year. He was married once, briefly, to a beautiful actress who played small parts in forgettable films. During the divorce proceedings, she threatened to tell the police everything she knew about the true source of her husband's income. An overdose of sleeping pills and alcohol was her fate. Afterward, he abstained from public romance for many months, which the press found endearing. The police weren't as impressed. Quietly, they tried to link Martel to his wife's death. The investigation turned up nothing. When finally he emerged from his blue period, it was with Olivia Watson on his arm. She was 33 at the time, a member of that lost tribe of English expatriates who stumbled into Provence and never seemed to find their way home again. Too old for modeling, she was managing a small art gallery that sold minor works. "And that," explained Ramona Stern, "is being charitable to the tourists who besiege the village each summer. With Martel's financial help, she opened a gallery of her own. She also designed a line of beachwear and a collection of Provençal-style furnishings. Like the gallery, both bore her name." "Apparently," added Ramona, "a fragrance is in development."
"What does it smell like?" asked Gabriel.
"Hashish," she quipped.
But was there another side to JLM Enterprises? A side other than hospitality and drugs? The case of Nuruddin Zakaria suggested it was so. The Moroccan had managed to insert at least 15 Kalashnikov assault rifles into the United Kingdom, an impressive feat of smuggling and logistics. Undoubtedly, he had used a portion of the network that moved Martel's drugs to Britain and the rest of Europe. But was Nuruddin the exception, or were there others? Fortunately, the office had in its possession several thousand French intelligence documents that Paul Rousseau had handed over after the attack on the Weinberg Center in Paris. With the help of an Alpha Group analyst in Paris, Dina Sarid compared the names in the database with known or reputed members of Jean-Luc Martel's army of dealers and enforcers, most of whom were of North African descent. Six names appeared on both lists: three Moroccans, two Algerians, and a Tunisian. Four of the men had served time in French prisons for drug offenses, two were thought to have spent time in Syria fighting for ISIS, but when Dina broadened the parameters to include second- and third-degree levels of association, the results were even more alarming. "JLM Enterprises," she concluded, "is an ISIS battalion in waiting." Gabriel forwarded Dina's analysis to Paul Rousseau in Paris, and Rousseau put the worst of the worst under Alpha Group watch. That same evening, the last member of the Barak team arrived in Tel Aviv aboard a flight from Zurich, where he had spent the past several days on a wholly unrelated matter. Entering room 456C, he paused briefly before the enlarged photograph of Saladin, bade him an unpleasant evening, and sat down at his old desk, where Gabriel had personally placed two towering stacks of files. He opened the first and frowned. "Ivan Kharkov," he murmured. "Long time no see, you miserable son of a bitch." It was Ari Shamron who once described Mikhail Abramov as Gabriel without a conscience. It was not an altogether fair characterization, but nor was it far from the truth. Born in Moscow to a pair of dissident Soviet academics, Mikhail had served in the elite Sayeret Matkal, Israel's version of the British SAS, before joining the office. His enormous talents, however, were not limited to the gun, thus the two stacks of files Gabriel had placed on his desk. In appearance, he was Gabriel's opposite, tall and lanky, with a bloodless pallor and colorless gray eyes. He was the Prince of Ice to Gabriel's Prince of Fire. During those intense days of preparation, he all but ignored Jean-Luc Martel and Olivia Watson. They were lights on a distant shore, or, as Gabriel liked to say, on the other side of a horseshoe bay. Mikhail had only one assignment, to prepare himself for the role he would soon be playing. Not by coincidence,
the character whose life he would inhabit had much in common with his quarry. Like Jean-Luc Martel, he was a man of two faces. One he showed to the rest of the world, the other he kept carefully hidden from view. Much of Mikhail's course of study was self-directed, as it involved Russian armaments, a subject he knew well. But Gabriel, in yet another departure from office tradition, personally oversaw the rest. On the evening Martel and Olivia Watson departed Saint-Barthélemy, he summoned Mikhail to his suite for a final examination. Gabriel stood before a video monitor, a clicker in his hand, while Mikhail sat on the executive leather couch, his long legs propped on the coffee table, his eyes half-closed, with affected boredom, his default expression. "Tintoretto," he said. Gabriel pressed the clicker, and another image appeared on the screen. "Titian," said Mikhail, suppressing an elaborate yawn. The image changed.
"Rembrandt, for heaven's sake, next!"
When the image appeared, he placed a hand to his forehead, in a show of deep thought.
"Is that a Parmigianino or a Perugino?"
"Which is it?" asked Gabriel.
"Parmigianino."
"Right again."
"Why don't you give me something a bit more challenging?"
"How about this?" Another image appeared on the screen. This time, it was not a painting, but the face of a woman.
"Natalie Mizrahi," said Mikhail.
"That's not what I'm asking."
"Is she ready? Is that what you want to know?"
"Yes."
"Do you want me to talk to her?"
Gabriel switched off the video monitor and shook his head slowly. It wasn't the sort of job for a lover, he thought. Only a chief could ask such a thing. Chapter 20. Jezreel Valley, Israel. Early the following afternoon, having cleared his inbox and returned the necessary phone calls, Gabriel eased into the back of his armored SUV and set out for the valley of his youth. The landscape beyond his window was yellowed, like an old photograph. Overnight, a Palestinian arsonist had set fire to the Carmel Ridge. Whipped by high winds, the flames had consumed 3,000 acres of highly combustible Aleppo pine and were now advancing toward the outskirts of Haifa. Israel's firefighters had proven themselves incapable of containing the blaze, leaving the Prime Minister no choice but to request international assistance. Economically crippled Greece had dispatched 200 men. Russia had agreed to send a tanker aircraft. Even the ruler of Syria, who was battling for his very survival, had mockingly offered to come to Israel's aid. Gabriel found his country's impotence deeply unsettling. The Jewish people had drained the malarial swamps, watered the deserts, and prevailed in three existential conflicts against an enemy far greater in number. And yet a Palestinian, with a pack of matches, could bring the northwest corner of the country to a standstill and threaten its third-largest city. Highway 6, Israel's main north-south motorway, was blocked at the iron interchange. Gabriel's motorcade turned onto Highway 65 and followed it eastward to Megiddo, the hillock where, according to the Book of Revelation, Christ and Satan would wage a climactic duel that would bring about the end of days. The ancient mound appeared peaceful, though it was shrouded in a sepia-toned veil of smoke from the distant fires on the ridge. They headed northward into the valley of Jezreel, keeping to the side roads to avoid the diverted traffic, until finally a security gate, metal and spiked, blocked their path. Beyond it was Nahalal, a cooperative agricultural settlement, or Moshav, founded by Jews from Eastern Europe in 1921, when Palestine was still in the hands of the British Empire. It was not the first Nahalal, but the second. The first Jewish settlement on this plot of land had been established not long after the conquest of Canaan. As recorded in the 19th chapter of Joshua, it belonged to the tribe of Zebulun, one of the 12 tribes of ancient Israel. Gabriel leaned out his window and jabbed the code into the keypad, and the security gate rolled open. Oleander and eucalyptus lined the gently curved lane that stretched before them. Modern Nahalal was circular in layout. Bungalows fronted the road, and behind the houses, like the folds of a hand fan, lay pastures and cultivated cropland. The children, filing out of the cooperative's only school, paid scant attention to Gabriel's large black SUV. Several of Nahalal's residents served in the security services or the IDF.
Moshe Dayan, perhaps Israel's most famous general, was buried in Nahalal Cemetery. At the southern end of the Moshav, the SUV turned into the drive of a contemporary-looking house. A security guard in a khaki vest appeared instantly on the shaded veranda, and seeing Gabriel emerge slowly from the vehicle, raised a hand in greeting. In the other, he gripped the stock of an automatic weapon.
"You just missed her."
"Where is she?" The bodyguard inclined his head toward the farmland. "How long ago did she leave?"
20 minutes, maybe a half hour."
"Please tell me she's not alone."
"She tried, but I sent a couple of the boys with her. They took one of the ATVs. None of us can keep up with her."
Smiling, Gabriel entered the bungalow. His furnishings were spare and functional, more office than home. Once, the walls had been hung with outsized black-and-white photographs of Palestinian suffering. The long, dusty walk into exile, the wretched camps, the weathered faces of the old ones dreaming of paradise lost. Now there were paintings. Some were Gabriel's, youthful works, derivative. The rest were his mother's. They were cubist and abstract expressionist, full of fire and pain, produced by an artist at the height of her power. One depicted a woman in semi-profile, gaunt, lifeless, draped in rags. He recalled the week she had painted it. It was the week of Eichmann's execution. The effort had left her exhausted and bedridden. Many years later, Gabriel would discover the testimony his mother had recorded and then locked away in the archives of Yad Vashem. Only then would he understand that the cubist depiction of an emaciated woman in rags was a self-portrait. He went into the garden. Smoke rose above the Carmel Ridge like the plume of an erupting volcano, but the skies above the valley were clear and perfumed with the smell of earth and bovine excrement. Gabriel glanced over his shoulder and saw he was alone. His security detail seemed to have forgotten about him. He followed a dusty track past the animal enclosure, watched by blank-eyed dairy cows. The farm's pie slice of cropland stretched before him. The portion nearest the bungalow was under cultivation of some sort. Gabriel affected a resentful ignorance of all matters farming, but the distant section of the parcel lay tilled and fallow and awaiting the seed. Beyond the outer boundary was Ramat David, the kibbutz where Gabriel had been born and raised. It was established a few years after Nahalal in 1926 and derived its name not from the ancient Jewish king, but from David Lloyd George, the British prime minister whose government had looked favorably upon the idea of establishing a Jewish national home in the land of Palestine. The residents of Ramat David were not from the East. They were largely German Jews. Gabriel's mother arrived there in the autumn of 1948. Her name was Irene Frankel then, and she soon met a man from Munich, a writer, an intellectual who had taken the Hebrew name Alon. She had hoped to have 6 children, one child for each million lost to the Holocaust. But one was all her womb would bear, a boy. She named Gabriel, the messenger of God, the defender of Israel, the interpreter of Daniel's visions. Their home, like most in Ramat David, was a place of sadness, of candles burning for parents and siblings who had not survived, of terrified screams in the night. And so Gabriel passed his days wandering the ancient valley of the tribe of Zebulun. As a child, he had thought of it as his valley. And now it was his to watch over and protect. The sun had slipped behind the burning ridge. Daylight was in retreat. Just then, Gabriel heard what sounded like a distant cry for help. It was only the first notes of the call to prayer, drifting down from the Arab village perched on the slopes of the hills to the east. As a child, Gabriel had known a boy from the village named Yusuf. Yusuf had referred to him as Jibril, the Arabic version of his name, and had told him stories of what it was like in the valley before the return of the Jews. Their friendship was a closely guarded secret. Gabriel never went to Yusuf's village. Yusuf never came to his. The divide had been unbridgeable. It was still. The call to prayer slowly faded, along with the last of the light. Gabriel gazed across the darkening fields toward the bungalow. Where the hell were his bodyguards? He was grateful for the reprieve. He could not remember the last time he had been completely alone. All at once he heard the voice of a woman calling his name. For an instant, he imagined it was his mother. Then, turning, he glimpsed a slender figure bounding toward him along the track, pursued by two men in an ATV. Suddenly he felt a stab of pain at the small of his back. Or was it guilt? "It's what we do," he reassured himself as he rubbed away the pain. "It is our punishment for having survived in this land." Chapter 21. Nahalal, Israel. Like Gabriel, Dr. Natali Mizrahi had had the distinct displeasure of seeing Saladin in the flesh. Gabriel's encounter with the Monster had been fleeting, but Natali had been obliged to spend several days with him in a great house of many rooms and courts near the northern Iraqi city of Mosul. There, she had treated Saladin for two serious wounds suffered in an American airstrike, one to his chest, the other to his right leg. Unfortunately, Natali and Saladin had met again in a tiny A-frame cabin in rural northern Virginia. A Caravaggesque painting depicting the instant before her rescue hung in Gabriel's appalling gallery of memory. Try as he might, he had been unable to remove it. This, too, was something he and Natali had in common. The story of her journey into the dark heart of the Caliphate of ISIS was one of the most remarkable in the annals of the office. Indeed, even Saladin, who knew only part of it, predicted that one day someone would write a book about it. Born and educated in France, fluent in the Algerian dialect of Arabic, she immigrated to Israel with her parents to escape the rising tide of anti-Semitism in her homeland and took a position in the emergency room at the Hadassah Medical Center in West Jerusalem. Her arrival in Israel did not escape the notice of the talent spotters of the office. And when Gabriel was searching for an agent to feed into Saladin's network, it was to Natali he turned. At the little farmhouse in Nahalal, he peeled away the many layers of her identity and transformed her into Leila Hadawi, an Arab woman of Palestinian lineage, a black widow bent on vengeance. Then, with the help of Paul Rousseau and the Alpha Group, he fed her into the pipeline of French and other European Muslims heading to Syria to fight for ISIS. She spent nearly a month in the Caliphate, in an apartment house near Al-Rashid Park in downtown Raqqa, in a training camp in the ancient city of Palmyra, and finally at the house near Mosul, where, threatened with death, she had saved the life of the greatest terror mastermind since Osama bin Laden. During the period of his recovery, he had shown her great kindness. He had referred to her only as Maimonides, the philosopher and Talmudic scholar who served as one of the real Saladin's court physicians in Cairo, and allowed her to be in his presence without veiling her face. Never once did she leave his side. She had monitored his vital signs, changed his bloody dressings, and muted his pain with injections of morphine. Many times she considered shoving him through death's door with an overdose. Instead, bound by her oath as a doctor and her belief that it was essential she report what she had witnessed, she had nursed Saladin back to health, an act of mercy he repaid by dispatching her to Washington on a suicide mission. It had been 3 months since that night, and yet even now Gabriel noticed remnants of Leila Hadawi in Natalie's bearing and in her dark eyes. She had shed Leila's veil and Leila's rage, but not her quiet piety or her dignity. Otherwise, there was no visible trace of the ordeal she had suffered in the Islamic Caliphate or in the cabin in Virginia, where Saladin had personally subjected her to a brutal interrogation. It had been his intention to execute Natalie in ISIS's preferred manner by taking her head, and her imminent death had the effect of loosening his tongue. He admitted he had served in the Iraqi Mukhabarat under Saddam Hussein, that he had supplied material and logistical support to rejectionist Palestinian terrorists such as Abu Nidal, and that he had joined the Iraq insurgency after the American invasion of 2003. Those three elements of his curriculum vitae represented the sum total of what the intelligence services of the West knew of him. Even his real name remained a mystery. Natali, however, had been granted access to Saladin's inner court at a time when he was physically enfeebled. She knew every inch of his tall, powerful body, every mole and birthmark, every scar. It was only one of the reasons why Gabriel had come to the farm in Nahalal in the valley of his birth. The evening turned cold quickly, as it always did in the Galilee. Nevertheless, they sat outside in the garden, at the same table where 10 months earlier Gabriel had conducted Natalie's initial recruitment. Now, as then, she sat very straight, with her hands folded neatly in her lap. She wore a snug-fitting blue tracksuit and neon-green trainers, soiled by the dust of the farm roads. Her dark hair was drawn away from her face and constrained at the base of her neck by an elastic band. Her wide, sensuous mouth was set in a half-smile. She looked happy for the first time in many months. Suddenly, Gabriel felt another stab of pain. This time, it was real. "You know," said Natalie, her expression serious, "you'll heal faster if you take something."
"Is it that obvious?"
"You're leaning to one side, to keep pressure off the fractures." Grimacing, Gabriel tried to imitate Natalie's erect posture. "And your respiration," she said, "is very shallow."
"That's because it hurts to breathe. And every time I cough or sneeze, I see stars."
"Are you getting any sleep?"
"Enough."
Then he asked quietly, "You?" Natalie drew the cork from a bottle of Galilean white and poured 2 glasses. She drank only a small amount from hers and then returned the glass to the tabletop. During the many months she had lived as a radicalized Muslim, she had largely abstained from alcohol. Her daily consumption of white wine, the office talent spotters had regarded it as her one and only vice, had fallen sharply since her return to Israel.
"Are you?" asked Gabriel a second time.
"Sleeping? I was never really good at it. Even before the operation. Besides," she added with a glance toward the exterior of the bungalow, "it's not exactly a house of secrets, is it? Every room is wired, and every move I make is recorded and analyzed by your psychiatrists." Gabriel didn't bother with the denial. The bungalow was indeed wired for both audio and video, and a team of office physicians had charted every facet of Natalie's recovery. Their assessments painted a portrait of an officer who was still struggling with the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. The officer suffered from prolonged periods of insomnia, night terrors, and bouts of severe depression. Her daily training runs in the valley had improved her overall health and tempered her mood swings. So too had her romantic relationship with Mikhail, who was a regular visitor to Nahalal. All in all, it was the opinion of Natalie's doctors and Mikhail that she was ready to return to limited duty. Limited duty, however, was not what Gabriel had in mind. He had Saladin in his sights. He shifted uncomfortably in his chair. Natalie frowned. "At least drink some of the wine. It might take the edge off the pain."
"He did. It didn't."
"He was the same way," said Natalie.
"Who?"
"Saladin. He didn't want pain medication. I practically had to torture him to convince him he needed it. And every time I fed morphine into his drip, he fought to remain conscious. If only I'd—"
"You did the right thing.
I'm not sure the victims in London would agree. Or Paris," she added. "You're lucky to be alive. And none of it would have happened if I'd killed him when I had the chance."
"We're not like them, Natalie. We don't do suicide missions. Besides," Gabriel went on, "someone else would have taken his place."
"There is no one else like Saladin. He's special. Trust me. I know." She warmed her hand over the candle that burned between them. The direction of the wind shifted subtly, bringing with it the acrid scent of the fires. Gabriel preferred it to the smell of the valley. Even as a child, he had hated it. Natalie removed her hand from the flame. "I was beginning to think you'd forgotten about me."
"Not for a minute. And I haven't forgotten what you went through, either."
"That makes 2 of us. She reached for her wine, but stopped. Layla's temperance, it seemed, had reclaimed her. "Mikhail assures me that one day I won't remember any of it. That it will be like an unpleasant memory from childhood, like the time I almost sliced my finger off playing with one of my mother's kitchen knives." She raised a hand in the darkness. "I still have the scar." The wind died. The flame of the candle burned straight. "Do you approve of him?" she asked.
"Mikhail?"
"Yes."
"It doesn't matter what I think."
"Of course it does. You're the chief."
He smiled. Yes, Natalie. I approve. Wholeheartedly, in fact.
And did you approve of that American girl he was involved with? The one who worked for the CIA?
Her name, added Natalie coolly, escapes me. Her name was Sarah.
Sarah Bancroft, she added,
stressing the first syllable of the rather patrician-sounding family name. Yes, said Gabriel. Sarah Bancroft.
It doesn't sound Jewish, Bancroft.
With good reason. And no, said Gabriel, I did not approve of the relationship. At least not in the beginning.
Because she wasn't Jewish?
Because relationships between intelligence officers are inherently complicated. And relationships between officers who work for services from different countries are unheard of.
But she was close to the office.
Very.
And you were fond of her.
I was.
Who ended it?
I wasn't privy to all the details.
Please,
she said dismissively. I believe, he said guardedly, it was Mikhail. Natalie appeared to consider his last statement carefully. Gabriel hoped he hadn't spoken out of turn. One never really knew what passed between lovers, especially where old relationships were concerned. It was possible Mikhail had portrayed himself as the aggrieved party. No, he thought, that wasn't Mikhail's style. He had many fine qualities, but his heart was fashioned of cast iron.
I suppose he'll be leaving soon, she said.
I have a few more pieces to put into place.
Operational spade work?
He smiled.
And how long do you suppose he'll be away?
Hard to say.
I hear you're turning him into an arms dealer.
A very rich one.
He'll need a girl.
Otherwise, Jean-Luc Martel won't believe he's real. Know much about him?
JLM?
She shrugged.
Only what I used to read in the newspapers.
Think he's involved in drugs?
That was the rumor.
I grew up in Marseille, you know.
Yes, said Gabriel flatly.
I think I might have read something about that once in your file.
And I treated my fair share of heroin overdoses when I was working there,
Natalie went on.
The word on the street was that it was Martel's heroin. But I suppose you can't believe everything.
Sometimes you can. A silence fell between them.
So,
who's the lucky girl? Asked Natalie at last.
Mikhail's girl?
I have someone in mind for the part, said Gabriel. But I'm not sure she wants it.
Have you asked her?
Not yet.
What are you waiting for?
Forgiveness.
For what?
Just then, a gust of wind rose suddenly and extinguished the flame. They sat alone in the darkness, saying nothing at all, and watched the mountains burn. It took Natalie only a few minutes to toss her belongings into a bag. Then, still dressed in her tracksuit, she settled into the back of Gabriel's SUV and rode with him back to Tel Aviv. Doctrine dictated that she take up residence at a jump site, a safe flat where office agents assumed the identities they would carry with them into the field. Instead, Gabriel dropped her at Mikhail's flat off Hayakon Street. He reckoned it wasn't a complete breach of protocol. After all, Mikhail and Natalie would be posing as husband and wife. With a bit of luck, they might even learn to dislike each other a little bit. Then no one would doubt the authenticity of their cover. It was approaching 9 o'clock by the time Gabriel's SUV started the long climb up the Bab el Wad toward Jerusalem. Provided there were no accidents or security alerts, or calls from the Prime Minister, he would be at Narkis Street by 1:30 at the latest. The children would likely be asleep, but at least he could share a quiet meal with Chiara. But as they were approaching the western edge of the city, his mobile phone flared with an incoming message. He stared at it for a long moment, wondering whether he could pretend it had somehow been lost in transmission. Regrettably, he could not. He was about to make his second trip abroad as chief. But this time, he was going to America.
Chapter 22 Lincoln Memorial, Washington.
Langley sent a plane for him. Never a good sign. It was a Gulfstream G650, with a leather antique interior, a large selection of in-flight movies, and baskets filled with unwholesome snack food. In the aft of the aircraft was a private stateroom. Gabriel stretched out on the narrow bed but could find no arrangement of his torso and limbs that did not cause him pain. The sky beyond his window never grew light. He was chasing the night westward. Sleepless, he had little else to do but wonder about the reason for his unexpected summons to Washington. He doubted it was social in nature. The new crowd in the White House wasn't in the business of playing nice. The plane touched down at Dulles Airport at 3:30 and taxied to a private hangar where a convoy of 3 armor-plated Suburbans waited, tailpipes gently smoking in the cold, damp air. The early hour meant that, for once, the traffic was light. As they crossed the Capitol Beltway, Gabriel glanced toward the Liberty Crossing Intelligence Campus, the former headquarters of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence and the National Counterterrorism Center. A thicket of trees blocked the view of the devastation. As yet, Congress had not allocated the billions of dollars necessary to rebuild Liberty Crossing, once a shining symbol of the chaotic post-9/11 expansion of the American national security state. Like the members of Paul Rousseau's Alpha Group, the staffs of the ODNI and NCTC had been forced to seek accommodations elsewhere. Saladin, if nothing else, had made a lot of spies and analysts homeless. The caravan of SUVs turned onto Route 123 and headed into McLean. Gabriel feared he was being taken to CIA headquarters. He avoided it when he could, but they sped past the entrance without so much as slowing and made their way to the George Washington Memorial Parkway. It carried them along the Virginia side of the Potomac to the glass and steel towers of Rosslyn. On the other side of the river rose the graceful spires of Georgetown University, but Gabriel's eye was drawn to the ugly rectangular slab of the Key Bridge Marriott, where Natalie had spent many hours trapped in a room with a French-Algerian terrorist named Safia Bourihani. Through a concealed video camera, Gabriel had watched Natalie record a martyrdom video and then wrap her body in a suicide vest. Only later, at the cabin in Virginia, would she learn the vest was inoperative. Saladin had deceived her, and Gabriel too. They continued southward along the river, past the fringes of Arlington National Cemetery, and turned onto Memorial Bridge. On the opposite bank, aglow as though lit from within, was the Lincoln Memorial. Normally, traffic flowing from Virginia to Washington was routed onto 23rd Street, but the 3 SUVs of Gabriel's motorcade eased slowly over a concrete median and then parked in the esplanade on the memorial's southern flank. A few uniformed U.S. Park police officers stood in the darkness, but otherwise the space was deserted. Just then, Gabriel's phone pulsed with an incoming text. He exited the SUV, made his way to the base of the memorial steps, and with one hand pressed to the small of his back, began to climb. A heavy tarpaulin, moving in the faint wind, stretched across the entrance. Gabriel shouldered his way through the breach and stepped hesitantly into the central chamber. Lincoln peered down contemplatively from his marble throne as though aggrieved by the damage around him. The base of the statue was pockmarked with tiny craters. So were the murals by Jules Guérin and the Ionic columns separating the central chamber from the side chambers north and south. One of the columns had suffered significant structural damage at its base. It was there that a member of Saladin's network had placed a backpack filled with explosives and ball bearings. The blast had been powerful enough to send a shiver through the White House. 21 people had died inside the memorial, another 7 on the steps, with the terrorist open fire with a handgun. And it was only the beginning. Gabriel passed between a pair of scarred columns and entered the north chamber, where Adrian Carter, his face tilted upward, was reading the words of Lincoln's 2nd inaugural address. He lowered his gaze toward Gabriel's face and frowned. "It seems the rumors were true after all," he said. "What rumors are those?" "About you being inside the headquarters of the Alpha Group when that bomb went off. Bad timing on my part." "Your specialty." Carter resumed his study of the towering panel. He wore a toggle coat
wrinkled chinos, and shoes that looked as though they had been designed for walking in the woods of New England. The attire, combined with his tousled, thinning hair and unfashionable mustache, gave him the air of a professor from a minor university, the sort who championed noble causes and was a constant thorn in the side of his dean. In truth, Carter was the chief of the CIA's Directorate of Operations, the longest-serving in agency history. His summons of Gabriel was a violation of protocol. Generally speaking, the Ramsar did not meet with deputies. Adrian Carter, however, was a special case. He was a spy's spy, a legend who, in the dark days after 9/11, had drawn up the agency's plan to destroy Al-Qaeda and roll up its global networks. The black sites, the renditions, the enhanced interrogation methods, they all bore his fingerprints. For a decade and a half, he had been able to tell himself and his critics that, for all his many sins, he had managed to protect the American homeland from a second terror spectacular. And, in the blink of an eye, Saladin had made a liar of him.
"My father brought me here to see Dr. King in 63, Carter said. "He was involved in the civil rights movement, my father. He was an Episcopal minister."
He glanced at Gabriel.
"Did I ever mention that?"
"Once or twice."
"I remember being very proud of my country that day," Carter went on. "I felt anything was possible. And I was proud when we elected our first African-American president, despite all the nasty things he said about the agency during the campaign. He and I had our disagreements over the years, but I never forgot what he represented. His election was a miracle, and it never would have happened were it not for the words Martin Luther King spoke here that day. This is our sacred space, our hallowed ground, which is why I'll never forgive Saladin for what he did."
Carter turned away from the panel and moved slowly into the central chamber, where he paused at the feet of Lincoln.
"You're the expert. Can it be restored?"
"Marble isn't my medium," replied Gabriel. "But yes, almost anything can be restored."
"And what about my country?" asked Carter suddenly. "Can it be fixed?"
"Your divisions are hairline cracks compared to ours. America will find its way."
"Will it? I'm not so sure."
Carter took Gabriel by the arm.
"Come with me. There's something I want to show you."
Chapter 23. Georgetown, Washington. It is not easy for the chief of the office and the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency to stroll unnoticed in Washington, even in the hour before dawn. But they did their best. Only a single bodyguard trailed them along the footpath at the edge of the Potomac. The rest were confined to the constellation of black Suburbans that moved in their orbit. Carter's pace was deliberate, thoughtful. For that much at least Gabriel was grateful. His back was ablaze with pain, a fact he could not hide from his old friend.
"How bad is it?" asked Carter.
"Unfortunately, they say I'm going to live."
"I hope the flight wasn't too hard on you."
"The Gulf Stream made it tolerable."
"It belongs to a friend of mine named Bill Blackburn. Bill used to work in the Special Activities Division. He was a real knuckle-dragger back in the day. Central America, mainly. Did a final lap in Afghanistan after 9/11. He owns a private intelligence shop now, calls it Black Ops."
"Clever."
"He is, actually. Bill does quite well for himself. I use him for jobs that require a bit of extra discretion."
"I thought you used me for those kinds of jobs."
"Bill and his men are down and dirty," explained Carter. "I save you for the ones that demand a little finesse.
It's nice to have one's work appreciated." They walked in silence for a moment. All around them the city groaned and stirred.
"Bill's been pestering me for years to come in with him," said Carter at last. "Says he'd pay me 7 figures the first year. Apparently I wouldn't have to do much. Bill wants to use me as a rainmaker to guarantee that the lucrative contracts keep flowing his way. The global war on terror has been very profitable for a lot of people in this town. I'm the only idiot who hasn't cashed in."
"You've earned it, Adrian."
"Would you take a job like that?"
"Not in a million years."
"Neither would I. Besides, I have more important things to do before they show me the door at Langley."
"Like what?"
"Like getting the man who did that."
Carter raised his eyes toward the Kennedy Center. A few minutes after the attack on the Lincoln Memorial,
a suicide bomber had detonated his device in the Hall of States. Then three more terrorists had moved methodically through the rest of the complex, the Eisenhower Theater, the Opera House, the Concert Hall, slaughtering all those they encountered.
"I knew two of the victims," said Carter, "a young couple who lived around the corner from me, out in Herndon. He did something in tech. She was a financial planner. They had life by the tail. Good careers, a mortgage, two beautiful kids. The house is for sale now, and the kids live with their aunt in Baltimore. That's what happens when people like us make mistakes. People die. Lots of people."
"We did everything we could to stop the attacks, Adrian."
"My new director doesn't see it that way. He's a real hard-ass, a true believer. Personally, I've always thought it was dangerous to mix ideology and intelligence," said Carter. "It clouds one's thinking and makes one see exactly what one wants to see. My new director begs to differ. So did the earnest young men he's brought with him to the agency. They think of me as a loser, which, in their world, is the worst thing a man can be. When I urge operational caution, they accuse me of weakness. And when I offer an assessment that's at variance with their worldview, they accuse me of disloyalty."
"Elections have consequences," said Gabriel.
"So do successful terrorist attacks on American soil. Apparently it's all my fault, despite the fact that I told anyone who would listen that ISIS was plotting to hit us with something big. According to the rumor mill, I'm yesterday's man."
"How long have you got?"
"A few weeks, maybe less.
Unless," added Carter quietly, "I can do something to dramatically change the landscape." At once, Gabriel understood why Adrian Carter had brought him to Washington aboard a private Gulfstream owned by an intelligence contractor named Bill Blackburn. "Does your director know I'm in town?"
"I might have forgotten to mention it," said Carter.
They had reached the Thompson Boat Center. They crossed a footbridge spanning Rock Creek and made their way past the Swedish embassy to Harbor Place. Perhaps not coincidentally, it was the same route three ISIS gunmen had taken that night after leaving the Kennedy Center. Here, their deadly handiwork was still in evidence. Nick's Riverside Grill, a popular tourist spot, was boarded up and closed for business until further notice. So were the more upscale Sequoia and Fiola Mare.
"How's your back holding up?"
asked Carter as they walked along K Street beneath the Whitehurst Freeway. "That depends on how much farther you intend to make me walk."
"Not far. There's just one more thing I'd like you to see."
They turned onto Wisconsin Avenue and climbed the slope of the hill to M Street. A block to the north was Prospect Street. They rounded the corner and after a few paces paused outside the entrance of Café Milano. Like the restaurants of Harbor Place, it was closed until further notice. 49 people had died there. Still, the toll would have been far higher were it not for Mikhail Abramov, who had single-handedly killed 4 ISIS terrorists. The restaurant was noteworthy for another reason. It was the only target where Saladin had made a personal appearance.
"A rather tragic symbol of our enduring partnership," said Carter. "Mikhail saved a great many lives that night. But it might never have happened if I'd heeded your warning about the man you bumped into in the lobby of the Four Seasons."
"You know what they say about hindsight, Adrian."
"I do. And I've always found it to be an excuse for failure."
Carter turned without another word and led Gabriel into the heart of residential Georgetown. The neighborhood was beginning to awaken. Lights burned in kitchen windows. Dogs led sleepy masters along red brick sidewalks. At last, they arrived at the curved front steps of a large federal-style townhouse on N Street, the agency's most exclusive safe property. Inside, the stately old house was like a walk-in refrigerator, more evidence that Gabriel's visit to Washington was private in nature.
"Did someone forget to pay the power bill?"
he asked.
"New regulations. The agency is going green. I'd offer you some coffee, but..."
"That's all right, Adrian. I really have to be going.
Pressing matters at home?"
"A chief's work is never done."
"I wouldn't know."
Carter wandered over to the thermostat and squinted at the dial, mystified.
"Please tell me you didn't drag me all the way to Washington to take a stroll down Nightmare Lane, Adrian. I was here, remember? I had an agent inside Saladin's operation." "A damn fine piece of work on your part," said Carter.
but it was all for naught. Saladin beat you in the end. And I know how much you hate to lose, especially to a creature like him.
What's your point?
Word on the street is that you've got something cooking with the